All right. Two other things. In past years, there's been an issue with people showing up late. And it's okay if you don't want to come to class. Okay. I'm not interested in wasting your time, and I'm certainly not interested in having you waste my time. But you are responsible for what's said in class. That's easier this year than it has been in previous years because I'm recording the lectures. Okay? But do not show up late. If that becomes a habit, I will make a practice of closing the door. If the door is closed and you come in anyway, I will throw you out bodily. And I mean that literally. And I will leave it to my choice whether I throw you out by the door or the window. And let me say, one year, when this had become a problem and when I instituted this policy, which I don't like, right? And I won't do it unless it becomes a problem. We had one very unfortunate circumstance. Somebody showed up late, they had just received notice, they just received the news of parent about it. Okay? And that's a very legitimate reason to come into a classroom late. God knows. Okay. The problem is, I can't stand here and negotiate with you at T plus 10 minutes about whether it's okay to enter the classroom. And what I did for this person after the class was over, I found out what had happened. I said, look, this is a legitimate reason. I still can't let the classroom be disrupted because for you it's legitimate, for the next person it isn't. And I went through the lecture from the day. Okay? So if there's a legitimate problem, okay, we'll work it out. If you overslept, I don't want to hear about it. And the reason is it's not fair to other people in the classroom. Okay. My policy on extensions is if you can bring me a note from your coroner, I will give you an extension of 24 hours. There are no extensions on assignments. Okay. So, that's it for administrivia. Now, first assignment. So, let me ask a question before I get to the assignment. How many of you have not seen much in the way of C or C++ code? Okay, how many of you feel that you're reasonably competent in C or C++ code? Good. Let's find out. If you go to the website you will find an online browsable copy of lots of versions of the Linux kernel. And since I haven't actually been there myself today, I do not know which version. Somebody who's trying to test getting thrown out. I do not know which versions are currently up, so I will send out the version number. What you gentlemen missed is if you show up 10 minutes late for class, I will close the door and I will remove you bodily from the class. Don't even show up. I will tell you which kernel version by email, which means you really want to be on the mailing list because you're responsible for what's on the mailing list. Okay? But, so, suppose that we were going to do the read system call in Unix. And we're going to do it on dev0, okay? We're going to do it for 4096 bytes to some buffer address. I'm leaving out the buffer address, and it doesn't really matter what the buffer address is. If you trace this into the Linux kernel, you'll discover that the read system call starts internally at a, and I'm, you know what? I'm sorry. You could not cast read because that's not legal. Okay, so we're going to open dev0, which is a file that's just an infinite sequence of zeros. We're going to get back a file descriptor. We're going to proceed to do a read call on that file descriptor. And hopefully what we're going to end up with in the buffer is 4096 zeros. Why you would want to do this is not clear to me. It would be much simpler to just zero the buffer yourself. But there are other circumstances where having a file that contains zeros actually does make sense. If you dig into the source tree or on the website, what you'll find is that there is a file called fs read write.c. And inside that file, you will find a function called sys_read. What I want you to do is simply trace through what happens when sysread gets called. Okay, and when I say trace through, here's what I want back for this assignment. Simply want an outline that says, from sysread, every procedure that was called in order, right, indented, from the time sysread is entered to the time sysread exits. Okay, so it's going to be something of the form right, sysread calls mumble, right, calls something. If procedure gets called more than once, I want to see it more than once. Right? So not just the first call, but every call. And what I want you to do is trace through the behavior of sysread as it works its way through the system. I'm almost to the point where I will bet $1,000 that nobody will get this assignment quite right, which is part of the point. I won't quite make that bet this year, but next year I might. I can't wait to see the negotiation with the dean when I go to try to put that through for reimbursement. But okay, why am I doing this? Why this assignment? Two reasons. So one is, I have learned from bitter experience that many people have a self-assessment of their C and C++ skills that is exaggerated, unfortunately. And nobody's going to get all the details right on this because it's a huge assignment. This outline is going to be very long, okay? And there's always something you'll miss. And there's always something everybody misses when they do this assignment, so don't feel bad about that. Okay? But if your reading skills for C are not up to reading your way through the code, they're for sure not up to modifying the code. And so every year after this assignment, we get a significant number of students who drop the course, having discovered that they don't really know C after all. So one purpose of this assignment is to convince you to drop the course if you're not going to be able to succeed. Right? And that's something I would hope you'd like to know before the drop deadline, maybe even before the add deadline. But the other, and this is the part that you're not going to believe until late in the course, but I've actually had students every year come back and say this to me later in the course. A side effect of doing this stupid outlining assignment is you will end up visiting all of the major parts of the Linux kernel, and you'll start to get a sense of where things live, what the data structures are, and just a little bit of how they interrelate. And later, when we do project assignments that involve modifying the kernel, you'll have some idea of where things are. Now, if you've already done a lot of Linux kernel hacking, this assignment, frankly, is just a nuisance. And I'm sure some of you have. But if you haven't, get some familiarization before you're asked to dive in and change a very large body of code is actually going to turn out to be a really useful thing to have. And we've had an example. I'm not going to use this project this year, but one of the projects that I've used in the past is a particular modification to the Linux kernel scheduler. And it turns out that assignment could be solved with 3 lines of code. The trick was to know where was the right place to touch. And that's very often the trick in kernel-level work. So having a sense of how the flow of the system works is actually quite important to successfully working in a kernel. The other thing I will say, every year I choose a different system call, although I have done this one before. And the choice is malicious. I very carefully choose system calls that can enter the scheduler, because the scheduler is a swamp, and it's a very important swamp to actually know something about. So you're going to discover places where there's a call in which the current process might call sleep. which is the internal procedure that you call if you need to wait for something and you want to let something else proceed. I do want you to trace through sleep at least once. And I will double check myself that the correct procedure name is sleep. Once you have traced through sleep once, it is not necessary to trace through again.
Okay.
The other major skill required for this is some knowledge of how to work a web browser. If you don't have that, you're for sure in the wrong classroom.
Okay. I also want to apologize. You know, the first lecture and a half, right?
There's a certain amount of boring administrative data, okay, and a certain amount of dire warnings. And I have to tell you that I find them as insulting as probably many of you do.
I hate the idea that I need to say to students in this classroom, you actually are responsible for some things and I'm really going to hold you to it. I would prefer to assume that that was the case. It was certainly the case when I went through school. Apparently, it's not universally the case here. And I've learned the hard way that if I don't say these things, the message does not get through. And here's the other half of the story, though. It is very hard to get an F in this course. Every year, I will give one or two what I call earned Fs. Right? Earned means you really worked for it, and you really earned it. If you don't hand in the midterm, if you don't hand in the final, if you don't do your projects, yes, you will get an F. I will actually look for reasons not to do that. So the negative point in the course is it's going to be hard. The positive point in the course is because I know it's hard, I actually work very with some attention to exercise a reasonable grading policy. Of course, it's hard enough without help from me. All right, so we started in yesterday with what's an operating system.
What I want to do today is talk a little bit about how we got to where we are now.
And this is not quite a historically accurate story. It's close.
There was some confusion about what order things exactly happened in. But the very earliest machines,
let me not go back to the very earliest machines. Let me go back to the first electronic computer, and there's some debate about whether that machine was built in the U.S. or in Britain. I'm going to go with the U.S. version of the fiction, which was the ENIAC, which was built at the University of Pennsylvania. And so here's the question. What makes a computer different from a calculator? Any intuition about it? And I'm not talking about a modern fancy calculator that has a billion functions on it. Just a four-function calculator, right? This is the kind of calculator that none of you have seen in the last 30 years because they don't make them anymore. Okay? Just take a normal four-function calculator, adds, subtracts, multiplies, divides. What's the difference between that and a computer?
Conditionals.
Okay, that's one. What else? You're absolutely right. Can you remember what computer is a shorthand for? They weren't originally called computers. They were called something rather longer and more cumbersome.
Pushdown automata.
No, pushdown automata is something for theory means.
I don't know how you get from pushdown automata to a computer.
Computer is actually a shortening of a longer phrase. You know what it is.
The longer phrase is stored program. And the important word in this phrase is store.
So, the other thing that differentiates a calculator from a computer is memory. Right? The ability to take a result and set it aside for later use. So, what is meant by conditional? So, a conditional is something and more specifically, not just conditional. So it's not just tests of the form is A greater than B, but actions based on those tests, okay? So specifically, it's the ability to do a conditional branch or a conditional jump. Right? It's the ability for the calculator to reach a point in the calculation and say, now based on what I've done so far, I'm either going to do this computation over here or I'm going to do that computation over there. And strictly speaking, there have been calculators with memories. And if you only have a memory, you don't have a computer yet. If you don't have a memory, you know, I could argue fine print you have a computer, but I don't really think you do, not in practical terms. But the critical element is this conditional branch. It turns out the conditional branch was an accident. It was invented in the course of the testing of the ENIAC machine. And this is a great story because it illustrates why one of the historical bigotries of computer science is so hard. Look around the room and count the number of women. Right? If this doesn't disgust you, it should. There are no women in the room, and that's appalling. And there are lots of reasons for this that we don't have time to go into in this class. This is not the right class to do it in. You guys wouldn't be here studying computer science if it were not for the action of a woman. And a woman who, by the way, has not been particularly celebrated for this. People, if they think of early women in computer science, they think of Grace Murray Hopper, who was brilliant and a major contributor. But it turns out that the conditional branch was invented in the course of writing programs for the ENIAC. And the ENIAC, you should understand, was not programmed by typing. Right? It was programmed by running cables from one place to another on the machine that governed the data flow of the machine. And the main purpose for which ENIAC was constructed was the efficient computation of ballistics tables. The problem is, I'm going to launch a bomb, right? And I want to know how far it's going to go if I launch it at a given angle and speed. And it turns out computing those tables is hard. There's a non-trivial number of variables involved. So there's lots of tables you have to compute. It's an error-prone process if humans do it. So the Army paid to have a machine built to do these computations. Now, there's an interesting problem with computing a trajectory. And I'm not interested really in whether we're doing it for a bomb or a potato chip. When do you stop? And the answer is, well, you're not really interested in what happens after the thing hits the ground. But in order to determine if it's hit the ground, you need to do the ability to test whether the altitude has reached zero yet and decide to stop the computation. And this is the canonical example of a conditional branch. It's if zero, then jump to halt. Now, the story goes that the ENIAC designers, who were celebrated PhDs, and if you look at the photos from the ENIAC era, you'll see them wearing the traditional white lab coats. We seem to have outrun that in computer science. Had neglected the need for this operation of the machine. Wasn't in the original design. And by the way, this wasn't known until we pulled out the archival papers. I say we. I was not involved in pulling out the archival papers, but a bunch of people at Penn pulled out the archival papers because the ENIAC 50th anniversary was coming up. Okay, and they wanted to go back and sort of build an exhibit. And it turned out, and nobody realized this at the time, half of the archival papers were at the university and the other half had made their way to the Smithsonian. And they actually had to do an exchange of documents in order to recover the story. But it became apparent that something nobody had quite realized. Everybody had known the story about the ballistics. Nobody realized that the original machine design did not include any kind of a conditional unit. The practice of the day was that the PhDs designed the electronics for this very powerful, expensive, sexy machine, and then they hired women to do the menial labor of programming. That was the world. So these women were writing these programs for this brand new machine. You got to understand, this was a machine that was brand new. It was not especially well documented. It was not an easy thing to understand. Right? This is sort of a nutsy attitude. And Mary Hobarton found herself working on the ballistics problem for the ENIAC and discovered that she needed to terminate the program, and the machine provided no means to do so. And so Mary invented a new cable. And the cable provided a mechanism to take the carrying output of what was called the accumulator, the add unit in the machine, and use that carry output, drive it back into the stepper, which was the thing that advanced the machine from one location to the next, and alter the value that the stepper selected. So the effect of this was that if the result of the compute was zero, you could cause the stepper to go to a different location. So there is a delightful or horrible irony in this, depending on your point of view. I think it's sort of both. That for the roughly 35 years following that invention, people in senior positions in computer science and mathematics spent 35 years telling women that women was no field. The computer science was no field for a woman to go into, and the field wouldn't exist if women hadn't done it. It simply wouldn't exist. So, look around the room, think about the demographics, and ask yourself what you will do to fix this in your career. Yeah?
Did she tell anybody about what she did?
You know, it's sort of funny. Sometimes you do these inventions, and you don't realize, except in hindsight, how significant they were. And when this story emerged from the archives, people sort of pieced it together. Many people who worked on the ENIAC project by this time were dead. As it happened, Mary Hobarton was still alive. She was in an elderly care facility and suffering from some of the symptoms of Alzheimer's. And as is often the case with people who have Alzheimer's, the early memories remain quite clear and the later memories become obscure. So Mary's memory of having done this work and her description of what exactly was done was absolutely crystal clear, and they were able to confirm by talking to her that what they had surmised from the notes was in fact what had transpired. Mary has since died, but really sort of quite an unusual story that was got unearthed in that process. So, but let me back up before anything. So I've done my social bit for the first lecture. I had an operating system get invented, right? So ENIAC was a machine where the model was you designed a problem, you custom cabled the machine to do the computation that you wanted to do, and when the computation was done, you literally tore the cabling down to set up the machine for the next computation. Right? It was very late in the game that the idea of a stored program came into existence. But it did come into existence, right? And so the next version after ENIAC, the big problem with ENIAC was it was built out of vacuum tubes. Vacuum tubes were not, at that time, terribly robust technologies. When you have 50,000 of them, one of them is burning out somewhere at all times. And the ENIAC machine really did have about 50,000 tubes. When William Shockley, who's credited with the invention of the transistor, although there are competing claims, came up with a transistor, Bell Labs couldn't see a purpose for it. But very quickly, transistors, which were initially used in analog applications and hearing aids, right, came to be used to build switching circuits and then storage circuits when combined with capacitors, and now we use them for memory cells and for computation. And the big advance of the transistor is not size, although that's important, and it's not heat, although that's really important. The fact that because they're lower heat, they don't fail, statistically speaking. So, very quickly, you move from ENIAC, which was a monster that would have occupied about half of the floor of this annex of this floor, and did. You move from that to smaller, more compact machines that occupied only a major chunk of this room, that were primarily programmed by flipping toggle switches on the front of the machine. Right. And you would effectively type in the program you wanted to run by flipping toggle switches to set the bit value that you wanted to enter, right? And then the last switch, which would say good, set this and move on to the next location. You might imagine that this process is completely error-free and that no mistakes are ever made doing this. And if you believe that, I have a bridge in Brooklyn. It's beautiful. Okay. Very quickly, people discovered this didn't work so well. Right. So the next move is to say, so one, I need a faster way to load these things because the loading of the program was actually the dominant cause of delay in using the machine. So I need a faster way to load them. And furthermore, I'd like a way to load them so that if I make a mistake, maybe I can only reload the part that's broken. Okay. And pretty soon, you see something called punch cards added to these machines. And a punch card is a single 80-line column of text, right, with little punch holes that could be sensed by a reader. I don't know if there are any punch card machines still in operation anywhere, except maybe in museums. And one of the big innovations of the punch card was that it had something called a line number. And the line number came into existence because sooner or later somebody with a big stack of punch cards would drop them. Okay. And the next thing was, right, you ever take a deck of cards, right, scatter them over the floor, and then try to put them back in order? It's like that. I mean, imagine that you're doing it with 5 or 10,000 cards. Okay. And the line number initially was for the humans to resort the deck. But very quickly, the card readers got smarter, and the line number came to be used as a way to say, hey, here's the location where this part of the program should go. And what would happen was the reader would read all the cards in, would then sort the lines for you, so that it now had them in the correct order, and having sorted them, it would then transfer them to memory. Or it would transfer them to the place in memory where you executed them. The other reason people like line numbers is card readers were not entirely reliable. Right? They were magnetic, mechanical devices, and periodically they would munch a card. In fact, not so periodically. Right? It wasn't unusual to feed a large deck of cards to a card reader and get back a somewhat smaller deck of cards with a few undocumented entries missing, you know, that had been torn up by the card reader on the way through the mechanical processing. If you've been through an airport recently where they take your ticket stub at the gate and they run it through this machine that sucks it through the machine and reads the stripe on it and then feeds you back, you know, your half of the ticket stub, it was a machine very much like that, except imagine that technology 40 years less advanced. Okay. So, good news about cards, much faster way to load the machine. Most of your work is now spent on some other device typing out cards. When you're ready to run your program, you bring your deck to the acolyte in the machine room who takes your deck, typically spills it on the floor for you just to make sure that your program is right, loads it into the machine, okay, and then 4 hours later when your program has done running, comes back to you with a diagnostic, right, which generally takes the form of rarely, here's your answer, or nope. Right, this was the extent of the error diagnostic you got. You wrote a large program, right? You handed it to the person in charge of the machine. The machines were expensive, right? So they had these priests, almost, who served them and stood between them and you. And your program went south. Now, the acolyte doesn't know anything about what your program is supposed to do. All the acolyte knows is the stupid red light went on the machine indicating the program failed. So imagine that there was no debugger, there was no printf, and you were going to submit a program at great expense. And basically, the diagnostic you were going to get back was yes or no. Not actually that much different from hardcore kernel programming, except the process is a lot better. Still, two things now happen. One is, people conclude, yep, these machines really are expensive. And just to calibrate how expensive, by 1970, people were selling operating systems for $1 million a copy. Nowadays, if you paid $7 a copy, you would think that was an outrage. I'm talking about mass licensing. $1 million a copy was not a significant fraction of the overall system price that you were paying. The hardware was what dominated the price. And people came to conclude that these expensive machines really needed to be used more efficiently than this. And gradually, you started to see a bunch of things added. Two particular innovations came out of Dartmouth University, the work of John Kemeny, and I forget Kurtz's first name.
Junkers?
Junkers. It's a great story about this. Dartmouth had come into possession of two machines from IBM. And the IBM service rep gets an order from Dartmouth for an unusually configured cable that's about 6.5 feet long. And they're very puzzled about this cable because they can see that the ends of the cable are designed to connect to the bus structures of the respective machines, but they can't figure out what in hell this cable is going to be good for. Right? They know from the cable design which machines it has to be, and they can't figure out any conceivable physical arrangement for these machines that would allow 6.5 feet of cable to successfully connect them. What was the cable for? Well, what they wanted to do, so they asked, what's this cable for? Right? And the Dartmouth guy said, what we want to do, we want to use one machine to run in a loop. And what this machine is going to do is it's going to periodically kick the other machine and tell it it's time to switch from one task to the next task. They were inventing timesharing. And the IBM people didn't really understand what this was about. It violated their sales model. But they're a little puzzled by this cable. And they spent something like 9 months scratching their heads about it and finally gave in and went to ask the Dartmouth guys what the hell this cable was good for, because they couldn't figure out how this was going to work. And the Dartmouth guys sort of laughed at them and said, here, let us show you our computer center. And it turned out that the Dartmouth Computer Center was a two-floor structure. One of the machines was directly beneath the other on adjacent floors, and so the cable was going straight up and down, which was a configuration that hadn't occurred to the IBM people. So Dartmouth invents timesharing. About the same time, Dartmouth and a few other people were beginning to play with what was called interactive computing. But interactive computing, you have to understand, given the cost structure, was an idea that might be characterized as heresy. Right? The idea was we were going to take this extremely expensive machine, and we were going to let this user, who was frankly kind of not very bright, actually type and interact with the machine directly. And you understand that an hour of time on one of these computers is measured in hundreds of dollars an hour at a time when $100 was still precious. So people were saying, we might even let multiple users operate on the machine at once. And the problem now is, if we want to let multiple users operate on the machine, we want to give each of them the illusion that they have a machine to themselves. Now, there's one piece of good news in all this, which is that from the perspective of the computer, you are a very slow peripheral. You just don't type very fast. And granted, processors were a lot slower then, but that was true then as well. So the idea that the Dartmouth guys had was, let's take the computer, we'll divide it up, and we'll have this timer mechanism, and we'll give you a couple of milliseconds, and we'll go on to the next channel, we'll give the next person a couple of milliseconds, we'll go on to the next person, we'll give them a couple of milliseconds, and eventually we'll come back around to you. This was called timeshare. At about the same time, various protection mechanisms started to show up on these machines. So the very first operating systems, the really first operating systems, were actually that small piece of code that was used to sort the cards after they were loaded from the hardware. And it wasn't called an operating system, it was called an executive. In fact, it was called a BIOS, a basic input-output system. You may have noticed that term has survived, but it means something rather different today. And as the Dartmouth people started to invent time sharing, they realized they needed some piece of code that would implement this switching function. And they further realized, well, there was a step in between. People said, we can reload the machine a lot faster if we protect the BIOS from the rest of the machine. So all of a sudden, you get the idea that there might be a partitioned memory where here's the machine memory, and we'll have the BIOS at the bottom, okay, and this thing will be user space. And There'll be some button that will push, and the effect of pushing this button is the user space gets zeroed, the BIOS survives, it goes out to the tape reader or the card reader, and it loads the next program and executes.
If they zero out the user space, how do they maintain whatever your session was?
This is now the version I'm describing as before the time transfer story. So you push the button when the last user is done. The innovation for Gartner was to say, what we need to do is we need to save this stuff so that we can go back to it. Okay. And somewhere around this time, and I could not tell you where this was done, somebody in the computing world discovered the washing machine. And I mean the clothes washing machine. And they built something that was called a drum. And they discovered that if they put a magnetic oxide surface around the outside of the drum and rotated the drum, they could write to the drum. And later they could retrieve from the drum. This is the precursor of the modern disk drive. So what the time-sharing people did initially was they said, what we'll do, we'll do swapping. In fact, this is before you have human interaction. Some people would have very long-running jobs and they would want to pay less. It wasn't so important that their job should run during the day. So the idea was you'd run at night, would make some progress, and you'd push it off to the drum, and then during the day, you would run the important programs. Important programs means programs for which people are willing to pay the most money. This is invariably accounting jobs. Well, the Dartmouth, by the time the Dartmouth stuff came around, this interface was getting a lot faster, and it became feasible to simply move the jobs in and out as you switched from user to user to user to user, provided you didn't run out of space. But now, the function of this BIOS is a lot more than just loading stuff off the disk. It now actually has to have some management and ownership responsibility for, by the time the Dartmouth machine is destroyed. And it has to know something about policy. It has to know how much time to give you before we go on to him. And it has to know something about how much memory you're entitled to. And most important of all, it has to know who to send the bill to. Expensive resources people charge for. A couple things happen after this. Number one, people observe that memories are getting faster and disk drives aren't. Disk drives are getting faster too, but not the same way. They said, we noticed that of the however much memory we gave you, by the way, this was typically measured in kilobytes. An early machine with a 12 kilobyte memory was a really expensive machine. And one of the observations that Yoffa Liebking made before he died, the size of the main memory, the primary memory on a machine has not changed in 30 years. It rose in the early stage to about 64 kilobytes, and your first level memory today on a modern machine is about 64 kilobytes. What has happened is that the layers of backing storage have become more sophisticated. But the amount of memory you can have that operates at about the same speed as the processor has not changed in 30 years. Now, that's kind of a weird way to look at a machine, but it's somewhat revealing. Right, we're talking about machines that have a gigabyte of main memory on them? No. That's tertiary memory. That's backing storage. It plays approximately the same role in this drive that in this machine. But memories are getting bigger by the time of the Dartmouth machine. They would continue to get bigger. And after a while, people noticed, when it was 12K, you had to make every instruction count. But when it's a megabyte, probably you don't have a megabyte of actual instructions to run. In particular, what you discover is programs run a lot of loops, sometimes productively. And you discover then that the program spends 10, 15, 20% of its time in a very small fraction of, 80, 85, 90% of its time in some very small fraction of the code, namely the loop. So people said, hey, maybe I don't have to take the entire user program out of memory. Maybe what I'll do, I'll share the memory. I'll push some of your program out, some of the next party's program out, and when I get caught, I'll bring them back. And there was a brief flurry of experimentation with an idea called segmentation, which went away pretty quickly because it was a nuisance. And people invented what was called paging. The idea is you divide the memory up into equal-sized chunks. And you add a translation layer. So what I see, if I'm a programmer, what I see is address 52 in my space might really be 452. And now you augment the operating system with knowledge of the paging structures. At this point, you have something that looks very much like a modern operating system. So what are the functions? Dealing with device interrupts. Initially, the time-sharing interrupt and the card reader interrupt, but we've got new devices over time. Dealing with multiplexing the processor across the users. Imposing some structure on the disk so that we can find things that are stored there. Dealing with multiplexing the memory across most of the users. Eventually, we see the introduction of networks. Right? And this is sort of the story of how what we now know of as an operating system kernel evolved. And I've told a mangled story, and I'm sure it's not faithful to history, and I'm sure that every historical timeline I've seen has missed important events, and nobody really quite knows what the story is, but at least not all of it. So this is how we got here. Yeah?
At that point, don't you need more helpful output than, you know...
More what?
More helpful output or diagnostics, you know, instead of either...
Yep or no.
Or no.
Yeah. So as it came to be the case that users interacted more directly with computers, so time sharing meant that even though the computer was expensive, I was only going to give you a tiny little fraction of it. So it was maybe conceivable that it would be cost effective to let you type that. And this was a huge upheaval because it took the acolyte out of the loop. But it also meant that you got more direct feedback about what was going on. One of the other major innovations that came out of the DARPA time sharing effort was a programming language that almost nobody has ever seen. It's called BASIC. BASIC was the invention of John Kennedy and John Kurtz. And in fact, there's been a recent revision of their version of BASIC called True BASIC. Right? But you know, Visual BASIC remains the most widely used scripting language in the world. Scarier than that, just kind of thing. And a lot of the advantage of BASIC was that it was interactive. You could type in a line, and the BASIC interpreter would immediately tell you the line was invalid. Right? And it could tell you things if something went wrong about where it had gone wrong. And it was a nice, small interpreter. And so it was able to give you fairly precise feedback about the status of your computation. And that changed the character of interacting with the machine. Since we're at 10 of, I will pick up this story tomorrow. I want to do a diversion of something that I think is not in the slides. I want to talk about the work that was done at Xerox PARC. Okay, so questions on any of this before we break? Probably would be good if I told you the due date for this assignment. I will get that out of the moment. And I will get out the proper kernel version of the moment. Other questions? Okay, thank you.
Okay. I just added a class to how do I get off the
I think there's another class coming up, so why don't we get out of my office and
I actually have another class after. Is there another time I can drop?
My office is two doors away, but I have to let the class come into the classroom.